All right, hello, and welcome again to Computer Science E52, also taught as CS50 at Harvard University. This week we're going to be talking about functions, arrays, and various other tools which you'll find useful in tackling problem set 2 for the course. So let's go ahead and look at what exactly is a function. So you may have heard examples of what a function might be thought of as in the C programming language and some coding examples shown in lecture by David previously. But let's just take another closer look at what exactly is meant by a function in C so we ensure that we have a comprehensive understanding of what exactly it is we're talking about here. So a function is just this grouped line of code, a set of lines of code which serve a common purpose. So you think of individual statements within C like printf, or perhaps you initialize some variable x to 0. A function contains multiple lines such as this, and we give them a common name and use them for some unified purpose. You can think of it as sort of a black box which accepts units input and then returns some output, much like you'd think of a mathematical function like sine or cosine, where you'd take in an angle and then return some real value based on whatever the input was provided. It's a little different from that, and we'll talk about how it differs in a moment, but for now just think of it as kind of being like that mathematical function that takes something in and then gives you something out, serving some purpose for you. So if we take a look at inside this black box, we see it's actually composed of C code, much like anything else we'd find in our programs. So we see here we have something called triple, we have a reference to an int here, some other int x, which we apparently use down here, and then we're returning some value, which is x times 3. So it seems like we're taking in some input x, and then f of x, which is happens when we evaluate f using the input x, apparently would triple that value and give us 3 times x when it's coming out of the function. Okay, so why are we even concerned with functions? Because it seems like the sort of code we place within a function we could just put within our main program rather than worrying about calling triple x or square x or anything else we might want to use. Why not just implement it right there when we want to use it rather than providing some sort of abstraction where we're giving a name to all these statements and keeping them separately? Well, there's a few different reasons for that. One is organization. It allows us to encapsulate some group of code that does one particular thing under one name. So if you just say x equals square x, as opposed to x equals x times x, it's very simple to read. You don't even have to think about the operations. You just say, oh, it's squaring it there, and that's providing the value back. Obviously, that's a simplistic example, but when we start dealing with more complicated sets of actions, you can easily see why it might be beneficial to just have a simple name for a complicated process. If you think about what exactly the functions sine and cosine in math actually are, it seems like it's a lot easier just to punch in sine x or cosine x or perhaps tangent x on your calculator rather than drawing out a unit circle and figuring out for yourself what the answer might be. So much in the same way as that works on your calculator, so it works in the C programming language, and it's often beneficial to keep these contained. Reusability is also a factor because if you write code once, why should you ever write it again? If you know how to tell the computer to do something, and it's something you're going to want to be doing frequently, and perhaps it's something you want to be doing frequently throughout the same file, why should you have those same lines contained within your code again and again, taking up space, when you can just place them in one place and then refer to them again and again? It saves you a lot of time, and it's especially helpful if you ever need to change that function in the future. Suppose you find a bug in your squaring function for whatever reason, and you have to go back and change it so it works again. Rather than changing it n times, where n is the number it appears within your code, you just have to make one change and everything will work out for you. So it's a great way to have sort of this portability so you can make a change in one place and it affects everything else. Okay, so how exactly do we implement a function in C? What exactly is the anatomy of a C function? So when we want to define a C function, we write it somewhat like this. We have a return type at the top. We saw before with that triple example that was something like int. So some primitive data type or some data structure that we can return. Basically, this is the type of whatever we're sending back out. So for example, if we were tripling an integer and we're giving out an integer, that might be an int. Then we have the function name, just whatever we're going to refer to this function as. And then a list of parameters contained within parentheses, separated by commas. And then within here, we just place some code. So what is an example of something we could use here? Just some semantics. When we say the header of a function, we're referring to these top two lines where we're just giving the return type, the name, and the parameters. And the rest of this, which contains the actual code block, which is the lines of code in C that are actually being executed when we call the function, that's referred to as the body of the function. So just a little bit of semantics so that if you hear something referred to as referring to the header or the body of a function, you know what that means. Okay, so let's take a look at this triple function once more. So we see that this triple function is of type int. Its name is triple, and it takes some parameter int x. Note that we're specifying that it's an int and that its name is x, much like we declare any variable within our main function. So we must also specify what this parameter, what type it is, and also what its name is. The reason for this is that this function needs to know what to expect to be passed into it. So when we're calling triple later, we're presumably going to include a number within those parentheses. So when our function sees that number, it knows, oh, I'm being passed an integer. This 7 is an int. That's how I should be interpreting it. And also, I'm going to call it x, because I'm told that my first parameter is called x. And then throughout the rest of this function, we can refer to that parameter that's been passed in that way. Does that make sense to everyone? Does everyone sort of see how parameter passing into a function works and why we can give a name there? Sort of an implicit declaration of a local variable we're going to be passed in. We'll talk a little bit more about what it means for a variable to be local in a moment, by the way, since I'm throwing out that terminology. And you can see here that we're also declaring another variable, which would also be actually a local variable, called int y, which exists within this function. And we're setting this equal to x times 3. So whatever value we're being passed in as input, multiplied by 3, being stored in this variable y. And then we're returning y. So what exactly does that return keyword mean? Yeah, so presumably some function, very likely the main function, originally called this. Somewhere in the main function, they wrote triple and then maybe a 7, for example. And that's going to be evaluated to some value. Presumably, we'd like it to be 21. And yeah, if it's implemented correctly. And that value is being returned. And whatever value is placed here after this return statement is what that function call gets evaluated to. So we'll see in a moment in an example how exactly that works within the syntax of C. Yes?
You're actually, as a result of this, getting the variable y out of the function, such that after you run this function, suddenly you've got a variable y, or it's just returning the value of that function, it's just returning, then why do you need a y?
That's a good question. Okay, so the question was, are we getting back a variable y, some new variable after this function executes that contains our value, or are we just getting the value? And the answer is, we don't get this new variable being passed back to the main function. This variable is a local variable, and we'll touch more on that in a second, what exactly that means and how we treat those. But you can consider this y as existing only within the context of this function. And in fact, you're right, it's superfluous. Let's get rid of it. Return x times 3, just return that value without containing... yeah, that worked out really well, didn't it? I swear I didn't plan that question. But yeah, that's entirely superfluous. We can just return the value. No need to create any new variables at all, since the main function would not, in fact, have access to that particular variable, but rather just the value. So let's go ahead and take a look. Okay. So let's take a look at how we can use functions and pass in parameters by value in order to do something interesting. So you'll see here, oh, this is kind of interesting. So that looks sort of like I'm declaring some functions, right? I at least have the header of the functions up there, but I'm not really including the body, which is a little different than what I just showed you in the slides. And the reason for that is that this is what's referred to as a function prototype. And I believe David showed this in some of the lectures, but we'll review it again just because it's an important point to make. So before you use a function, before you can call it somewhere within the file, like for example here, I'm calling getPauseInt, you have to declare it. So you have to say, okay, there's going to be a function of type int, it's going to be called getPauseInt, and it's going to take, in this case, no parameters. Or in the case where I have a void function, which means it doesn't return anything, though it can do something, for example, print to the screen. And it's called prettyPrint, and it takes some parameter that's of type int, and we're going to call that parameter x. And the reason I can do that is because now it knows what parameters to expect and what it's called, and if it wants to know what it does during compilation, it can just look at the bottom of the file where I have, in fact, included the entire declarations of these functions. So the reason for this is purely out of convenience. This means that I can include the names of all my functions, but not have the trouble of all those functions being grouped at the top of my file so that I have to scroll all the way down just to get to my main function. I can put them conveniently at the bottom of the file. And that's honestly the only difference here, is that I'm including declarations at the top and then the full implementations of the function at the bottom. And we call that a function prototype. Okay. So let's take a look at what, is that clear to everyone, by the way? I should probably stop for a second in case that is a little weird, because it's different than the way you might typically think about declaring functions. Okay, I'll assume you're on board then. Let's take a look at what this function is doing. So apparently this program is using functions to square a user inputted int and then print it out nicely, prettily perhaps. So first, we're declaring this integer x, which is contained within our main function, using getPauseInt. Okay, so that seems relatively straightforward. Okay, so it's just prompting us to enter a pause. We're first declaring this local variable x, setting it to 0, and then asking the user to enter a positive integer until they do. See, we're checking that x is not less than 1. While x is less than 1, we'll keep asking them. And as soon as that's false, we know we have a positive integer and we move on. And then we return x. Is everyone convinced that that does, get me a positive integer? Okay, so now I have this nicely encapsulated block of code that I can use any time to get... I'm sorry, was there a question?
What if the user doesn't... Oh, I see.
Okay, yeah, just to highlight that actually, since I might have skimmed over that a little quickly, if the user provides me something that is not an int, actually, getInt will keep asking until it gets an int. That's just how getInt works. It doesn't quit until it gets something that is, in fact, an integer. And then I do this check to make sure that if x is less than 1, so it's a non-positive integer, I keep asking until I get one that is, in fact, positive. And so I'm guaranteeing that I'll eventually get a positive integer. And so here I have this block of code, which I'm calling getPauseInt, which returns an int, that allows me to get a positive integer from the user every time. And this way, if there's any case where I want to get a positive integer from the user, I can just write int something, wherever I want to store it, perhaps x, y, number, whatever I want to name that variable, equals getPauseInt, parentheses, and that's already implemented for me. And you'll see here that we're actually setting this variable x to the function call. So when you see getPauseInt, this name of the function and the parameters, you can sort of see that as being a placeholder for whatever that's going to return. So getPauseInt, parentheses, actually evaluates to whatever the return for that function is going to be, given the input, which is nothing in this case. It's going to depend on what the user plugs in. And then after it finishes executing, it passes that value back. You can think of sort of a... In fact, just to illustrate this, the program gets to this line. It says, okay, I have an int x. It's equal to getPauseInt, no parameters. Okay, so it jumps down to this function. It says, okay, int x is 0. I want a positive integer from the user. The user passes 1 in. Let's say they give it 5. Okay, so we go up here, and effectively for the computer, this now says int x equals 5, because that's what getPauseInt evaluated to. Is that clear to everyone? That's just an important point. Okay, good. So then we get here, x is perhaps 5, and we run this function called squareX. And whatever squareX resolves to, whatever it returns, given our input, which in that case was 5, is going to be set as the new value of x. Okay, and that simply returns x times x. So in this case, it returns, if we give it a 5, 25, so the square of 5. And then just one last function, given some number, it just prints out this nice box using ASCII characters, and then you'll see there, %d is replaced with x. Yes?
What if the number is, say, 300?
What if the number is 300?
Yeah.
And it...
Three digits?
Well. Oh, in this case, here? So technically, this function only pretty prints for relatively small values of x. It's not a very robust pretty print implementation, I'm afraid. But it'll serve our purposes for today. But thank you for pointing out that, in fact, this is dependent upon that. it's all aesthetics, guys. Come on, it's subjective. Cut me a break here. All right. But yeah, so that's effectively how it's going to work. That's actually an interesting point because there is something I could do using a width and precision modifiers here. If I inserted a number 3, for example, I could guarantee that it reserves 3 spaces for that number. We'll talk about that more later when it's relevant to solutions in the problem set. But for now, just know that we could do something more robust there to protect the prettiness if we wanted to. Yeah. Okay, so let's actually just step out of this. Is everyone comfortable with what we saw? Any further questions before we run this and make sure it works? Okay. So .fun2, make fun2, /fun2, enter a positive integer, say 5, your number squared is 25. Oh, in fact, I want larger numbers than that, so let's try something 16, for example, 256. Okay, for numbers such that the square is between 100 and 999, this is absolutely great. But yeah, we can make that more robust in the future. Okay, so now that we're sort of more comfortable with sample function calls. Oh, actually, one more thing before we move on to a different segment. Let's take a look at this function call here. So we have a more or less complete program here. So we have a function that sets x to 5, y to triple x, passing in x. So we pass in what gets passed into that triple function. Yeah, it's the value 5. And then we return x times 3, so that's 15. And then what is y? Y becomes 15. What about x? It's still 5. These x's are distinct from each other, so we don't have to worry about anything happening there. Okay, and we'll talk about y right now when we discuss variable scope. So I've been talking about local variables when I'm referring to variables which are declared within a function. So what does it mean for a variable to be local? So a local variable is one that's declared within a function. This includes the main function, in fact. So if you declare a variable within main, int x equals 0, that variable is local to that function. So essentially, that name x refers to the variable you're talking about only within that main function. If you call another function and try to use x, you're not going to have any luck because it doesn't know what you're talking about. And if you call a function and declare a variable there and try to use that at a higher level, it's once again not going to know what you're talking about. We touched on this earlier when we talked about creating that local variable y within, I believe it was the triple function, and whether or not it had any bearing, and it actually does not, because it's created within the space which is reserved for that function. It's local to that space, and it has no bearing on anything that happens anywhere else. You can sort of think, a global variable, by contrast, is declared outside of all functions. So that space in your program where you're doing things like pound including different libraries, pound defining constants, we'll get to that later in the lesson, and anything that's not contained within that main function, that can be a space that you use to declare global variables. And global variables are applicable anywhere. You can access the values there and change them from within any function. It doesn't matter where you are, you can get to your global variables. This is useful if you have one piece of information that you want to share throughout your entire program. It contains something like it's particularly relevant to everything, and you need to have access to it at all times. It's generally ill-advised to make a lot of use of global functions, even though they seem very conveniently powerful. The problem with them is that if all functions are able to access them at any time, you can't really make a lot of guarantees, at least not easily, about what order functions are accessing those values and what the values contained within them may be at any time. If you don't have a good conception of why that is just yet, once you start using global variables, I assure you that you will. And just try to take it for granted, for now at least, that global variables are a bit dangerous and that they should be used with caution, because you can get yourself into situations that you didn't anticipate and have unexpected behavior from your programs as a result of your assumptions about what is contained within them not actually being valid. And there's another way to think of local variables and global variables is kind of like different types of authorities. So you can think of the local variables as having jurisdiction over the function within which they're contained. And that's where their authority is recognized. Like the name X means something within this local variable space, within this function, but not anywhere else. And then you have like a global variable, which is like Batman, which doesn't have any jurisdiction. It can just do anything and go anywhere and it doesn't matter. So that's just like another way to think about it, if that makes more sense to you. Okay, so passing variables to functions. Just a finer grained review of what exactly is happening here when we're passing this parameter in. So we're talking about whether or not a function passes back a variable. We should also talk about whether it's being passed in a variable, or if it makes sense to think of it that way. It turns out, not really. It's being passed in the value contained within some variable that's used as a parameter, but it's not really getting access to the variable itself, like that box in memory that we call x that contains this value 7 that we're assigning to that piece of data in memory. So essentially what's happening here is we're writing int x equals 7, so we're declaring and initializing this variable x. We're getting this spot in memory, which is large enough to accommodate an int. The computer is going to refer to it as x. We're also reserving this space y, which we're now going to fill in with whatever func x, func being some function, evaluates to, whatever that's going to return, given x, which in this case is 7. So let's take a look at what exactly is happening here. Okay, so we're getting out this value 7. It's being passed in as the input. So this is the local x. And then it's returning 49, which is sent into 49. So even if this value x, wherever it's stored for the function, this, you can think of this as being the local variable, the parameter being passed in, is changed, it doesn't make any difference because R7 is still up there in x. We just made a copy of it and sent it over to this function and let it do whatever it wanted to it. We don't care. It can tear it up, it can set it to 0, it can do anything. But Rx is still safe and sound back here because we just passed by value as opposed to passing by reference, which would have given it access to x. We'll talk more about that later, or we'll focus a little bit on it in terms of arrays, but in terms of regular variables, that's to come later in the course. But for now, know that if you pass in some variable called x into a function, you're passing it by value, you're giving it its contents, not the location where you're storing the original copy. And that means the original copy will not be changed. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay. So let's take a look at a second sample function call. So what about in this case? So we're passing this in by value. So this is getting at 5, and we have x being set equal to x times 3. So what's x? If we pass in a 5, what's x now after that first line executes? It's 15, okay. And then we return x. And so I guess y gets set equal to 15, right? What is y now? Is that true? Okay, so y is 15. What's x? It's still 5. Right? And that might seem less than intuitive because we just set x to 15, and yet x is still 5, you say? So why is that? Right. They have the same name, but they're different variables. It doesn't matter. You can call them whatever you want. Just because the names happen to be the same has absolutely no bearing. If that weren't true and you included some library, like a math library, and they just happened to name their local variables x, and you had some variables x in your other functions, then you'd have name collisions, and then you'd be changing things and never know what's what. But because we have this local variable system where a local variable is different from a variable in some other function, even if they have the same name, because they're local to their own function, we don't have to worry about this type of name collisions, and we can safely change the local variable without worrying about the original one being changed. So just to show that again, even if these names are the same, it doesn't matter, because we can just change all our references to the local x to some other name, and it does not change our code in the least. That similarity in naming between the two functions is entirely irrelevant, and you don't need to worry about it ever. We're just passing the value in. It never knows where this 5 really is, and it can't do anything to it. Okay.
Is that bad style to name it the same, or is that?
It often doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. It's generally bad style even to use things like int x, because if I'm reading your code and I see int x, I have no idea what you're storing in that integer. So in general, try to provide more suggestive names. If you happen to have a situation where in main it really makes sense to name something a particular name and then the function also has that, that's okay. It doesn't really make a difference as long as it's intuitive and not like inherently confusing. And you'll come to recognize those situations. It's usually pretty easy to know when you're like doing something that's going to inhibit someone's ability and understand it. you don't really have to worry about trying to avoid those collisions when it's irrelevant.
So now local variables are local to a function. Are they local to every sort of thing that goes into a curly brace, like a do while loop and all sorts of other things like that?
So at least for for loops, when you... So at least for for loops, if you initialize, for example, the counter variable, that counter variable is local only to that for loop, only to that code block. I believe that it's true for other loops as well. That's something that you might want to post on the bulletin board at help.cs50.net about, just to confirm. But I do think that that is true.
I seem to have tripped over that more than once.
Over what? The bulletin? Oh, yeah. Well, that was because of what we talked about before, the different C standards. Just to reiterate, I don't believe I repeated the question. The question was whether or not variables are local to any code contained within curly braces, or if it just applies to functions. And I believe that the answer is, at least for for loops, if you declare a for loop, if you declare a counter variable within a for loop, like for int I equals 0, and then the rest of the for loop, that I is local to that for loop. And I believe for other loops, that's also true. For example, if you had a while loop and declared some variable within it, I think it's local to the while loop, but that's something that I'm not entirely sure about and which you should check out on your own, either on the course bulletin board at help.cs50.net or by just doing a Google search about that topic. It's likely to have several results come up that are helpful. Okay, moving on from there, let's take a look at another example. Oh, and I even stayed connected this time. Great. Okay. So in this example, I'm attempting just to square the value again. So I want to take this variable x. I'm getting a number, storing it there. I call square x because I want to change x. And I set y, which is the variable we pass in, to y times y. And then I'm done, because it's just a void function. I'm just changing that value I just got passed in, right? And then I print out the squared number. So this should work, right? Okay, let's try it. Make fun1, slash fun1. So I'm going to give it a 4. Okay, so something seems to be wrong. I'm still getting a 4. Does anyone see what I messed up on, actually? Oh, well, the first thing I messed up on was I didn't open the right file this time. But here, okay, so I have this. Okay, so what's happening? Why isn't this squaring? What's that? No, that's actually okay. You can do the prototype and then declare the rest of the function later, but you can also just put the whole thing up here. That's not it.
You're not saving the value of square x.
Oh, okay. But I mean, it's
x equals square x.
Okay, I could do that, but then my function's void, so it's not actually returning anything. So that's a problem too. I mean, but I'm just like, I'm passing in x, and then it has x, and it's changing it, right? So I mean, then x should be different. But actually, no, because I'm not passing the variable in. I'm only passing the value, you see. So when I get some integer into x, say it's a 5, and I pass x to square, it's actually not getting access to that little box, that x box that contains a 5 in it. It's only getting the number 5. So then it's setting its copy of the number 5 equal to 25 and doing absolutely nothing productive with it, just finishing. And then when I print my x, it's been, once again, safely unchanged, and it prints out 5. Does everyone see what I did, or perhaps more accurately, did not do? Okay, so if I were to change this so that it does work, I would, as was helpfully pointed out, make x be assigned to square x, and then change my function appropriately such that it does return an int. And what it returns is the number that was passed in, which I just happen to be calling y in this function rather than x, times itself. Does everyone see why that change makes sense? Okay, so let's go ahead and run this and make sure that I got it right this time at least. 16, 256, which I do believe is the square of 16, so seems like we found our bug. Okay, what do we got next? All right, is everyone comfortable with, or at least more or less comfortable with what just happened here? So just to recap, when you pass in a parameter to a function, you have this, suppose your variable is contained somewhere in main in this box called x. It's contained in this box that has a 5 in it. You have some function that takes x. It gets 5. It doesn't know where this box is. It can't change this. It has 5 in its own box. It just made a copy. So it can do whatever it wants to that copy, but it can't change our original x. So that's pass by value, essentially. And that's how passing variables to functions generally works. Pass by reference is something different, which we'll get to later in this section. OK, so for now, we'll move on to talking about something a little different, magic numbers. So has this been mentioned in lectures? Is this something everyone's familiar with? What is meant by a magic number? It's a very special number with mystical properties. You've probably all heard of it. It was in all the papers. No, okay. So actually, it's just a constant value which is hard-coded into a program. So for example, if I'm just writing a bunch of code and everything's, you know, abstracted in these variables and everything, and then all of a sudden I have, like, if I is less than 37, do this. And I don't tell you what 37 means. I just write 37, a big 37 in my code somewhere randomly. That's what we would call a magic number. So it just kind of appears there out of nowhere. No one's really sure how it got there. It doesn't really make any sense. Anyone reading the code doesn't know how to interpret it because it's just this value 37. And it's very cryptic. It's hard to interpret what's going on in the program when you don't understand why these random numbers are popping up. So at least in the context of computer science and programming, magic's bad. And it's something that you're going to want to tend to avoid. So how can we avoid this? What if we want to do something 37 times? How do we handle that? If we can't write 37, I mean, I guess we could do something like, you know. Can you see this section of the board anyway, by the way? Yes, on camera. Just okay. I just don't want to be doing something that can't be seen. All right, so I could just write int num and set that equal to 37. And then when I write my condition, I could write if, for example, I less than num. So I have this stored in num somewhere. And then I at least have a name for it. So I could call it something, you know, hopefully more helpful than num. And then have some understanding of why I'm including that number, maybe. So that's sort of a solution, right? But the problem there is then I'm using up memory in the computer to, like, store this variable that contains a 37. Which is kind of wasteful, because I'd actually be more efficient by just writing the 37, because then it's hard-coded and I don't have to, like, store this 37 somewhere for no reason. It's kind of a waste. So if there was some compromise where I could, like, just basically include the constant value without storing it in a box somewhere in the computer, but also make it readable for the user, that'd be great. Does anyone think of an example of how? Yeah, that's actually another good idea, too. You could just put a comment over it. Maybe if it's like I is less than 37, you put, you know, // above the line, like, this number 37 means this. So that's very close to what we'll end up doing. But we actually have a syntactical tool that accomplishes exactly what the comment would do, but even more concisely. So here's an example of what we're trying to avoid. We have this example where we're iterating through a for loop exactly 8 times, and we just have I less than 8. And, you know, we don't really know what that means. And we're doing stuff 8 times. And this we consider bad, because it's kind of cryptic. We can use a pound define statement to accomplish what we'd have if we used a comment, but allow us to sort of inline a name for it. And the convention here is we include near the top of the file this phrase pound define, the name of the constant, the name we're giving the constant in all caps, and then whatever value we want to assign there. So in this case, the name is still a bit cryptic because it's just num iters, which means the number of iterations. But if you were doing this in an actual program where you're trying to accomplish something, there'd naturally be sort of a more intuitive name to provide there. For example, if you're doing something for every letter of the alphabet, you could say num in alpha, for example. Which might seem silly because everyone knows 26, but if you're dealing with a foreign alphabet, perhaps, and you want to make your code portable, then you could just change that number at the top, and suddenly you're able to do something once for each letter in a different alphabet. Yes?
I have a couple questions about it.
Sure.
Is it hard-coded, you say, does it use RAM?
Sort of, yeah.
Not as much as if you were to find it with
RAM. Yes.
Okay. And then can you, like, here you specified an integer 8, could you also, without, because you're not putting int, you know, num iter 8, could you also use a word, like, for a constant, like, string?
Constant string.
I don't know where you would use that, that would be applicable, but, or a char.
So I don't, So the way this essentially works is the compiler is going to first look at your pound define statements and basically look for everywhere num iters appears and then replace it with an 8. I'm not sure if the compiler would complain if you tried to use like a string, for example, and then have it would allow you to do that. It would just simply do a find and replace, essentially?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so
I think there's some special thing for strings specifically.
Is there?
The quotation marks being special.
Okay. Oh, yeah, so you probably have to escape the quotation marks somehow.
There's like a hash mark involved.
Okay, so apparently with some special syntax, this is actually something that I haven't had to do before, so I'm not exactly sure on the syntax for doing something like that, and I can't imagine a situation in this course, actually, where that'd be necessary. Yeah, it's good to ask questions like that. It keeps me on my toes. Sorry?
You can make them like function with arguments, but it's
Best
to plan because there's no type check.
Right.
So you could pass a double to it, and
okay, so we can certainly do a lot of interesting things with this, which are actually a little bit beyond the scope of this course, and I'm gonna try not to go into too deep right now, since I do want to touch on some other things. But apparently, the answer to the question, which I wasn't intimately familiar with, but I trust him on, is that there is some functionality for this, although the syntax would be a little different. Typically, you're gonna find yourself using this for constant values, like just some integer. Or perhaps like a float value, some decimal, and that can be subbed throughout your program. On the topic of decimals, for example, if you want to pound define pi, just pi, and make it 3.14, so it allows you just to have sort of these shorthand names for constants, which are perhaps a little easier to look at and read and understand than the numbers being written out themselves. Okay, so everyone can see the value of using pound define to avoid magic numbers and why this is in fact better. Okay, great. Let's see. Okay, so now we're going to be talking about arrays. So does everyone sort of have at least a loose understanding of what I mean when I'm talking about arrays? Okay, so if we're talking about just like a regular variable, an int x, for example, which we've been using all section, it's just this one box that contains some integer, right? So what if I created like an array of ints? So then we have a set of these boxes, which are in a row, a contiguous section of memory, we might say. This row of boxes all next to each other that have one name. And it allows us sort of to store a list of the same type of variable. So we can have a set of values, all of one type, stored together and place them together in one name. So you can sort of imagine certain situations where this might be useful. And let's take a look at actually how we'd implement this within the C programming language. So suppose I write something like int numbers square bracket 4. So I'm declaring an array. It's called numbers. It's going to contain values of type int, and I want space for 4 of them. So then I have these 4 boxes, which have these index values 0 through 3. So we start counting from 0. I believe I talked last week about when we use for loops. We want to start counting from 0 as opposed to 1, even though it might seem more natural to us to count from 1, 2, 3 on our fingers. One of the reasons we do that is because when we're dealing with arrays and we want to deal with each of the elements in them in an order, we're going to want to iterate starting from 0 because we have this convention that we refer to the first element of an array as the, in fact, 0th element. And if that seems a little weird, think of it as being the element which is distance 0 from the beginning of the array. It'll make more sense why we think of it in that way over time, but just as sort of a shorthand notation in your head for remembering why that happens, that might serve some purpose. Okay. And you'll note these all start as question marks. We may have talked about this a bit when we discussed variable initialization last week. So I've just declared this array of 4 integers, so I've just created 4 integers in memory, basically, right? And I can do with them whatever I will. Why am I putting these question marks there? They're all zero, right? I haven't done anything yet. Why am I putting question marks instead of zero? That seems weird. Especially if we've programmed in like Java or Python or something where we like know that. Yeah, I haven't initialized them yet. I didn't say that they're zero. I just kind of assumed that because, you know, if I've done anything to an integer, like, you know, it stays a zero. I didn't make it, you know. That's actually not true, however. Because just because I reserved this space in memory to put integers in doesn't mean that the computer went ahead and cleaned it out for me. That's not true at all. It didn't set every bit to zero. So whatever was here before, it's still there. And if I tried to look it up, then I might find some garbage data is what we generally refer to it as. So you can never count on a variable which you've just declared without initializing as actually being empty. And that's important to remember when you start working with arrays. So if you want everything to be zero, you better go through and set everything to zero. Okay, so suppose I want to access an individual element of this array, which I'm going to tend to want to do and change it. So I write something like this. If this array is called numbers, numbers square bracket zero, so I want to access the zeroth index value, the zeroth element of this array, and set it to 7. And when this executes, that is indeed what happens. We get a 7 place there. So we can think of that individual box as being called numbers 0, and the entire array is being called numbers. And then if we change numbers 1 to 8, similar result. Numbers 3 to 2, don't have to do this in order, there's no reason we have to. That changes. And numbers 2 to 5, and that works out for us too. Does anyone have any questions about what just happened? So when we're declaring the array, that square bracket notation is used to denote how many variables we want to set aside, how much space we want in memory that's together. And when we use it when we're changing the value, when we're referring to this variable after the array's been created, we're saying, okay, in the array numbers, give us the zeroth element. We want to do something to that. We want to set numbers 0, which is what we're calling that box, to some other element. So the notation might seem similar, but it's actually very different in these two cases. So it's important to remember those distinctions when you're working with arrays. Okay, and we can also initialize an entire array at once. If I just wrote int numbers 4, so give me an array of size 4, and set it equal to, in curly braces, elements separated by commas, this would change the 0th element to 7, the 1st to 8, the 2nd to 5th, and the 3rd to 2. So we'd just get the array filled in that order. And so we're just setting aside enough room for everything. And then this is actually, if you've studied any higher level math which involves set theory, the exact notation for sets. If not, you just remember that it's curly braces with the elements inside separated by commas. And you're able to initialize the entire array this way. So if you just want to store a bunch of numbers in a list, you can do this. If you want to have a set of variables that you can change individually, you can do that too. And in fact, if you initialize it like this, you can also go on to change these again. So it's not like it makes it permanent or anything like that. So don't get the impression that it does. All right, so let's take a look at the contents of an array. So if I just pull up, I believe it's array 1.c. Okay, so I've set some number containing, some array containing 6 numbers, 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, and 42, and I've just implemented this loop that goes forever. 1, it means true, you don't have to worry too much about that. 0 is false, every other number can be considered as true if you just use it in a condition. Generally, that's bad form. You don't want to do it. This is just sort of hackish for the purposes of the demo. Do as I say, not as I do, as it goes. So we print index, get an integer, and then print the element which is there. So I'm printing out whatever's contained at the, for example, nth index value of the array when I type in n. So for example, if I type in 0, I should get 4. If I type in 2, I should get 15, right, because we count from 0 from the beginning. So let's just take a look at this and validate that it does, in fact, work. So if I type in 5, I should get, I believe it was 42, and we do. And 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. And we see that we can access each of those as individual variables contained within the array.
How about
17? 17? That's interesting. Didn't put that there, did we? So what happened? Our array is only size 6. Why was I even able to type in 17? Yeah, I didn't, but it gave me back a value. It didn't just crash. The computer didn't explode.
It
what happened?
Crash.
It could crash. What number should I try now? How about I just hit the keyboard a bunch? Oh, seg fault. That sucks. Okay, so what happened is the computer just knows, okay, you want 17 past the beginning of the array? Okay, I'll go to the start of the array and go to the where the 17th value would be. But we only declared an array of size 6. So there happened to be this number in memory, just like I told you. Uninitialized space, just something happens to be contained there. And if we go too far, we go into memory that we're not allowed to touch, and we get a segmentation fault. So if you find yourself running into a segmentation fault at some point, perhaps on this problem set, maybe you should check how you're handling your arrays and whether you're overreaching the bounds of your arrays, as that will often be the cause of errors such as this. Yes?
Just for argument's sake, the 17, was that based on the numbers in the array?
No, that actually had nothing to do. I just chose 17 because it was thrown out, or I think you threw it out. Yeah. You threw it out. Okay. Yeah, it was just a random number from the audience, right?
Would that, if you put 17 and if you write it again, would it always give that same number?
Probably not. Let's see. Not that time. Let's try it again. It's just a number that happened to be in the system at that location. Has nothing to do with really anything we did. It's just random garbage data. We can't make any assumptions about it. Okay. So, since we're a little low on time, get through the rest of the slides here, cover the rest of the topics. Multidimensional arrays. So we've talked so far about arrays where you just provide a single index value. So it's sort of like you have, for each number, there's some value up to a certain limit, and you just denote each one with one number. So that sort of suggests like a linear array, right? It's just stretched out in a line. You have these boxes that are placed next to each other. So with multidimensional arrays, you can sort of think of it as like a grid, because you're going to be mapping using more than one coordinate. So like sort of like the Cartesian plane, where you have a point and it's like, I refer to this point as x1, y1. I have those two numbers to describe what it is. So if, for example, I had something that I was trying to keep track of that it makes more sense for me to think of as being two-dimensional or three-dimensional or four-dimensional or n-dimensional, I can use an n-dimensional array and just include those values at, for example, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 2. So just as I'd write numbers 0 to access some element, I might write tic-tac-toe 0 and then in a second pair of square braces 0. To denote some location in the array which I'm describing using these two numbers. It would look something like this. So you can think of this as being the zeroth row, the oneth row, the zeroth column, and the oneth column. And if I combine those, I have these four elements within the array, which I denote as 00, 01, 10, and 11. Okay, so that's somewhat interesting. And it's interesting for us because we can think of it in geometric terms, but if you think about it, everything in computers is just numbers, right? More accurately, it's just bits. So it's just ones and zeros. So when the computer writes information, it's just writing it like 100110. And just because we're thinking of this in geometric terms where we have like one thing positioned above another in like this abstract data space, doesn't mean the computer is suddenly going to start writing things like 100101 in like a grid fashion for us. So it seems weird that we even make the distinction between these two different types of array. One is like just this long string in a way, not a string like a string of characters, but just sort of this one-dimensional list. And this other is sort of a grid, like a matrix we can fill in. And the truth is that there's actually no difference at all to the computer. That looks like this. It's simply a different way of referring to the same thing. So if we declared, for example, this array, which was 2x2, actually I skipped over this, but I shouldn't have. The way we might declare that was by writing something like int grid 2x2. So essentially we're declaring a two-dimensional array, which is of size 2x2, much like we'd declare an array of 5 elements as int numbers 5. This is int grid 2x2. this is just a different way for us to think about it and a different way for us to denote each of the elements. To the computer, it's all the same. It's some list of four elements in a particular order. That's more a point of interest than anything, but gives you some insight into what's actually going on under the hood. So it's a new referencing method, but it's our same old data structure. All right. So what about passing arrays to functions? So arrays aren't exactly primitive, are not primitive data types. They're sort of a collection of these primitive data types. So I have like a set of ints. So we normally pass things by value. So a number has some value, a number x, as it's equal to 7. We pass it to a function, we're passing in 7. But if we pass an array, what's the value of a set of numbers? Is it a copy of the set of numbers? If we have an array of 256 numbers and we try to pass it to a function, are we going to say, hey, here comes an array, 1, 7, 18, 29, 42, 6, 5, 4, whatever. No, we're not going to do that. That seems wasteful, especially if we have very large arrays, to pass all these values into a function, to make another copy of them in memory just so that the function can do something with them and access them. And so the solution to that is actually that in the case of an array, rather than passing by value, we're passing by reference. And what this means is, unlike the case where we're just passing in the value in our variable x, which we want to protect and not let other functions touch, we're going to let the other function in on the location of our array, where exactly this box is. And we're going to let that function access this array consequently. And the way we do that is actually very simple. Let's see, not here yet. Let's see. I believe it's array 2. All right, so we see here we have a function which we have a program which apparently declares and initializes an array of ints having length 7 and then scales the second element by 2 using a function. And this means that when we pass it to the function, it has to be able to actually access the array and change it, not just get a copy of it. It has to get the original thing, the real deal. And you'll see here that this function takes in an argument int numbers square bracket, the square bracket indicating that this is, in fact, an array of numbers as opposed to just some integer called numbers. And then it's changing this second index value, so actually the third number, but at the number at the number 2 element, and scaling it by 2. So it should change this 4. But this seems a lot like an example I saw before. So I'm a little skeptical, but we're saying that we're passing by reference. So let's see if when we print out that value, it's actually 8 instead of 4. And although I did this in my section yesterday too, although I forgot to print a new line, you see the 8 there and that it did in fact change it. And so we are able to pass the array by reference just by passing its name as a variable of type int with those square brackets at the end denoting that's an array. That allows us to pass an array by reference and make changes to it within that function. So we're essentially giving that function the location of our array, telling it where that data structure is so it can change it. This is distinct from pass by value because we are able to change our original numbers contained within the array or characters if you contain characters in the array. Within this function by passing it to it. Does everyone appreciate the distinction between passing by reference with an array and passing a primitive data type by value? Okay. All right, so just touching on strings and the nature of what exactly a string is. So as this, I believe this has already been revealed in lecture, kind of stripping away some of the abstraction we introduced in CS50.h, but a string is really just an array of chars. If you think of what a word is, for example, it's just a sequence of letters placed adjacent to each other. So in C, a string is represented by just a string, an array of chars, which is ended by a null character, which is just written /0. That's technically two keys on your keyboard, but when the computer sees it, it thinks about it as a single character. So to just recognize that. And if I write string plain text equals oh hi in quotes, for example, this is what I actually get. I get this array of chars, which contains capital O, lowercase h, lowercase a, lowercase I, and then this exclamation point, followed by this /0 character. And then this is the end of the string, because, for example, if we ran printf and tried to pass in %s and pass in the name of our string, we know that we're not telling it how long the string is, right? We're never saying, oh, this is a string of length 25. But when it reads through this and gets to that \0, it knows it's at the end. Okay, so that's just C's way of indicating when the end of a string actually is. Okay. So now we're going to talk a little bit about crypto. Just the last thing we're going to be talking about this section. This is going to be useful on problem set 2. So these have already been covered within lecture, but we'll just review them very quickly. So the first thing we have is the Caesar cipher. Can anyone just like recite back to me how that works exactly?
Shifting in the alphabet.
Yeah. So it's basically equivalent to raw n, where n is some number from 0 to 25. So the way this works is if you use Caesar cipher and choose the number 6, for example, A goes to G, B goes to H, etc., because that's 6 letters ahead in the alphabet. And that's what all the Caesar cipher is. So to encrypt using the Caesar cipher, raw 6, for example, A goes to G, and if you wanted to decrypt it, send it back, G goes back to A, etc. You just do the opposite operation. Yes? Does anyone remember? I don't believe it was today's lecture. I think it was talked about last Wednesday. So you should be able to find it there. If you look over the lecture notes, those should tell you like a summary of the subjects, and then you can check the video for a more detailed explanation. Okay, so Caesar cipher is relatively straightforward. Vigenère is somewhat more sophisticated. So in Vigenère, you're not only given the plain text, but you're given a key, which is a string of characters. And each of those represents a different type of cipher. So X, for example, being the 24th letter in the alphabet, represents a raw 23, because you're sending A to X. So you're sending the first, that denotes what A is sent to. So for example, you send the first character to the 24th, so it's raw 23. Y would be raw 24, and Z would be raw 25. So essentially here, you're iterating through each of the different ciphers represented by these characters from beginning to end for each of your plain text characters. And then to decode, you just rotate in the reverse direction. So just for an example of this, let's say I want to decode my secret password. And encrypted, it's zipkick2, and the key is secret. So the way I do this is, I'll think of, okay, so I have this cipher X, and I decode that using the inverse of rot 24, which would be, in one, you could think of it as going back 24 letters, or just going forward 2. Given that, I'm sorry, I'm using the key secret, so it's different, but you can analogize it to these letters. And essentially the way this works is I think of, I have the S cipher, whatever that represents, I run that backward on Z, it gives me an H. I have this E cipher, I run that backward on Y, gives me a U. C backward on P, gives me an N. It goes 2 letters back, no, because C represents rot 2. Then K, backward R goes to T, I takes me back to E, K takes me to an R, and 2 is not encrypted or decrypted because it's not an alphabetical character. If you get to something like a 2, an exclamation point, or a space, skip over it, but don't skip over a letter in your key. You'll want to still use the next one that was in your key to determine what the cipher is for the next alphabetical character within Vigenère. Okay, so that's essentially all the information we have to cover about crypto, which should prepare you for this week's problem set. Are there any questions before we wrap up section? Okay, so the question was whether or not it's legit to use some outside password cracking tools on the Hacker Edition of PSET 2, which tasks you with breaking some passwords of some users, which are given to you with a passwords associated with their user IDs. I would say that it's reasonable to use some tools, perhaps, to try to give you insight into what you might be looking for, but that all the methods that you use within your own code, your own solution to get extract these passwords should be your own, and you shouldn't make any assumptions about what the passwords might be in your attempt. For example, if you use another tool and find out that one of the passwords is like leet hacks or something like that, and then you just have a program that like returns leet hacks as one of the passwords, that's not okay. But as long as you're actually writing up some code that is going to, through some method that makes sense, actually find this password, then that seems legitimate. Okay.
Any other? You also said today in lecture to just cite anywhere that you referenced significantly in a significant way.
Right. Yeah, that's also just generally a good thing to keep in mind. If you make use of any outside code resources to give you some insight into how to solve a problem, and you find yourself using an algorithm which is very similar, it's important to cite those ideas. It's really never okay to just copy and paste code from somewhere else into your assignments. That sort of defeats the purpose of what we're doing here. But if you do some research and stumble upon code which is relevant, simply citing the algorithm and where you found it should be sufficient. Anything else? The question was, where does that null terminator character at the end of arrays come from? And sort of a multi-part answer. Given a regular array of ints or just chars, for example, it might not be there at all. It's not there, in fact, unless you put it there. When we're dealing with strings, the convention is if we're treating an array as a string, then that array is expected to be some array of chars where the one following the end of the word immediately is that null terminator character. So if you're implementing some functionality using strings, for example, what we did in the CS50 library where we created a type called string, essentially the way that worked is when you create a string, you're getting all those characters from the user, that string, and when it's placed within quotes like that within C, it means treat this as like a string of characters, which just means in, according to the definition of C, a string is actually ended by a terminator character. So we're creating an array with enough space for all the characters you typed in, plus that terminator that's implied by the double quotes, since that's a string. In general, arrays will not contain that null terminator. When we're dealing with arrays of chars that we want to treat as a string, it does have to always be there. If you take input from the user that is treated as a string or placed within quotes, you can think of it as ending with a null terminator, because that's just the way a quoted input works, or strings passed in from the user the command line. Those are treated as strings, and they have that implicit null terminator. In other cases, that's not there, and you shouldn't assume that it is. Does that make some sense? I feel like it's sort of a broad topic.
It's particularly important to place that null character there if what you have is an array of chars.
Right, so if you're just filling in element by element an array of chars, and you want the computer to see it as a string, then you have to place that null terminator there. And that's something you might encounter on this week's problem set, perhaps, depending on how you implement it.
So if you want to use functions like strlen for your string length, you would need that null character to be there.
Strlen, I believe, expects a string, mm-hmm. which we revealed to be a char star, actually.
It seems to work on other arrays, or maybe I was only working with arrays of chars.
If there's a zero in the array, it will be wrong.
Yeah, zero, I believe, is the representation of... the null terminator character. And there's actually a resource that you'll find very useful for this problem set, which shows all this information called ASCII table. So you'll see that zero, since chars are essentially just numbers with a less of a range because they fit in one byte, which we interpret as characters, zero does represent that null character. So if you had a zero in an array of integers and using strlen, it looks for that null terminator, sees a zero value, interprets it as a char, and thinks it's the end of a string.
As soon as it sees that null, it's going
to
stop it.
Because strlen is written to interpret an array of chars, so it's hard-coded to look for this null terminator character. So when it sees zero, it thinks it's done.
Okay. I think I'm starting to understand.
So if you wanted to find the length of an array, it doesn't really make sense to think of it like that, because there's not really like anything at the end of the array saying, this is the end of the array, unless you place that null terminator there, and that is really only used in convention with strings. Any other questions before we wrap up? All right, thank you guys very much, and we'll see you next week.